Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Jack Lepiars. Tonight we have a lecture presented by the Boston University Department of Philosophy, co-sponsored by the BU Center for the Study of Europe and the French Consulate of Boston. Our speaker is Sandre Laugier, professor of philosophy at Université de Paris 1, Panthéon-Sorbonne. Professor Laugier's lecture is titled Philosophy of Popular Culture, Skepticism, Care, and Ordinary Life. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Boston University Professor of Philosophy, Juliet Floyd.
I'm very, very pleased today to welcome Sandre Laugier. Sandre and I have been friends for doing philosophy for over 30 years, so it's a personal privilege. But she's also really, I think, the most distinguished importer and exporter of American philosophical ideas into and out of France, Europe, and so on. She is professor of philosophy at Université de Paris 1, Panthéon-Sorbonne, and she's a senior member of the Institut Universitaire de France. She is the director of the Sorbonne Center for Contemporary Philosophy at Panthéon-Sorbonne and the Institut des Sciences Juridiques et Philosophiques de la Sorbonne. So she works on an enormous range of material from Emerson and Thoreau through Peirce, Quine, Stanley Cavell, Carol Gilligan, as well as, we'll see today, popular culture, Hollywood movies, and American television series. She's a former student of the École Normale Supérieure, where she worked with, among other people, Claude Imbert, who was a kind of mentor of mine from France. And she has published very widely and extensively on epistemology, philosophy of language, ordinary language philosophy, Wittgenstein, Austin, Cavell, moral philosophy, moral perfectionism, the ethics of care, American philosophy, of course, gender studies, democracy and civil disobedience, as well as popular culture. And she is the primary and most important translator of Cavell's ideas into French. She also is a mandarin des mandarins. She is very high up in the institution of French research. She's acted as the deputy director of the Institut des Sciences Humaines et Sociales at the CNRS, and she has been a primary force behind the study of gender across the social sciences and in many, many fields in France through her work at the CNRS. And she has visited around the world, Berlin, Italy, Johns Hopkins. She's been at BU, Boston, Harvard. So she's really a very international European philosopher. I will say that she is a very active columnist for Libération, and if you read French, you should keep up with what she has to say about popular culture in France. After the attacks in Paris, there was a wonderful analysis of the phrase, je suis Charlie, and why that is in the first person and not in some other form of grammar. So she does many things and is a very lucid and wonderful writer, both of French and of English. Yeah. So thank you very much. Let's welcome Sandre.
Thank you very much, Juliet. It's a great honor and pleasure to be here. So I'm going to talk about popular culture, and I'm very happy because I don't have that many opportunities to present this subject. And so my point today is popular culture because I think philosophy has not yet adequately observed or analyzed what I call the democratization of art in this digital age, nor has it addressed the blurring of the distinction between amateur and professional practices in some artistic settings. And maybe this is because philosophy still lacks the necessary analysis and theoretical tools and has not clearly grasped or accepted the pragmatic shift of culture toward the public space. And so it is essential to use new analytical tools to examine this democratic art and, conversely, the emergence of artistic practices or digital practices as resources for renewing democratic claims and forms of life. And you remember maybe Walter Benjamin reflected, it was in 1939, reflected on the consequences of new techniques of mechanically reproducing visual and musical works of art. And this is also something Erwin Panofsky noted about film. He said that film was first and foremost a medium of popular entertainment, devoid of aesthetic pretension, which reestablished the dynamic contact between art production and art conception. And film is really, and this is what Stanley Cavell's work is about, film is really where you have this connection, dynamic contact between production and reception. And this is something that Panofsky said was sorely attenuated in many other fields of artistic endeavor. So it's true that film and now TV are the main point of association, articulation of the, you know, the public and art production. And maybe there's a change underway in the field of culture and the hierarchies of culture. And maybe it is marked by the change of attitude toward television, so popular culture, but what I'm interested in now is television series, which are now seen as spaces where artistic and hermeneutic authority can be appropriated and where viewers can be re-empowered by constituting their own unique experiences. And this is what the critic Robert Warshaw had in mind when he wrote in a great book, not well known, I am afraid, called The Immediate Experience, that culturally, it's quotation one, culturally we are all self-made men. I would say self-made woman, of course, now, but it's the 60s. So we constitute ourselves in the particular choices we make within the dizzying array of stimuli that offer, that present themselves to us. And so this is exactly the situation we are in with the, you know, digital media, new media in general, the fact that we are surrounded in with so many things, but still the reference is ourselves. So we are self-made men, women, self-made people. And so this democratization of artistic production that was first promised by Romanticism would not now be realized in these new artistic forms and modes of participation and also interaction, because there is not only, you know, the TV shows, the production, but there's also the whole conversation, democratic conversation that digital technology allows, opening the way for new forms of subjective authority. And here, again, it is a question of democracy and a question of our capacity for individual expression and unique aesthetic choices. And here, maybe through this democratization, art and film have gone from being elitist to being essential drivers of social intervention, innovation, creation, and somehow they have become part of the creation of true democracy. But, of course, if by democracy we mean not only institutions, you know, constitutions and so on, but also the demand for participation and voice in the public life. And so this is the idea of democracy I'm trying to defend in my defense of popular culture. My reference here, of course, is Stanley Cavell. You were, of course, very kind to remind the role he had in this whole reflection. And he was really the first to account for the transformation of theory, but also of criticism, brought about by reflection on popular culture and what was seen at in the early 20th century, for example, as ordinary objects. And so, of course, Cavell talks about mainstream cinema and film, but he was also concerned by reversing some kind of hierarchies and also by the self-transformations that is required by the experience of film. the encounter of new experience. If you go back to the quotation by Robert Warshaw after the confusing multitude of stimuli, he adds something more than the pleasures of personal cultivation is at stake when one chooses to respond to Proust rather than to Mackie Spillane and so on. And he says when one has made the right choice, so the culturally correct choice, Mackie Spillane and Sterling Hayden do not disappear. And this is a great need, I think, for criticism of popular culture, which can acknowledge its pervasive and disturbing power without ceasing to be aware of the superior claims of the higher arts, and yet without a bad conscience. So why do you have this capacity of popular culture to be aware of the traditional culture, but still to claim something? It's something that Cavell has described in The Claim of Reason when he calls philosophy the education of grown-ups, but you can also call popular culture and film like that. And he explains that film is something that's a popular film because you share it with so many people, is something that has this function of transforming us, because education of grown-ups, since you cannot grow much higher, especially for me, that's it, then it's something that means changing, transforming yourself. And so the value of culture lies not only in the, you know, great art tradition, even if, of course, he acknowledged this, but in its transformative capacity. It's the capacity you find also in the moral perfectionism, Emerson and Thoreau. I'm not going to talk about them too much, but this is very present, and as you are going to see in the scene I'm going to show. And so in the philosophy, you always need to bring your language and life into imagination, and its quotation too, to confront your words and life as I pursue them with the life my culture's words may imagine for me, to confront the culture with itself along the lines in which it meets in me. So you see this idea of popular culture, and it's very clearly defined by Cavell, it's about sharing a culture, but culture that meets lines that meet in yourself. And this is also why Cavell is so interested in his favorite object of study, the apparently minor genre of remarriage comedy, because in these comedies that he describes in Pursuits of Happiness, I don't know if you have read, all of you, this wonderful book, but you should, and where he studies all these movies. Ah, voilà. Yes, so in these comedies, you have a kind of mutual education of the couple. So they fight a lot. So it's always about separation at the beginning and reconciliation at the end. But before the reconciliation and coming back together, you always have all kinds of conversations. And here, I give you an example. It's a fight, but that somehow is very revealing and somehow educating. And it's a fight about also what matters, what is important. And this is something that is essential in popular culture too. So I show you just a few minutes of this scene. So it's with it's Philadelphia Story. It's with Katharine Hepburn and Cary Grant. There she's flirting with James Stewart. So there are many men for her in this this movie, actually. And so she's seeing her former husband, so ex-husband, he's coming to crash the wedding, and she's not getting married to James Stewart, but to another man. You won't see him, but he's mentioned, and he's quite ridiculous, so that's it.
Hello.
Hello. Fancy seeing you here.
Orange juice? Certainly.
Don't tell me you've forsaken your beloved whiskey and whiskies.
No. I just changed their color, that's all. I'm going for the pale pastel shades now. They're more becoming to me. How about you, Mr. Connor? You drink, don't you? Alcohol, I mean.
Oh, a little.
A little? And you a writer? I thought all writers drank to excess and beat their wives. You know, one time I think I secretly wanted to be a writer.
Dexter, would you mind doing something for me?
Anything, what?
Get the heck out of here.
Oh, my dear Red, I couldn't do that. That wouldn't be fair to you. You need me too much.
Would you mind telling me just what it is you're hanging around for? Oh, no, no, no. Please don't go, Mr. Connor.
Oh, no, no. Please don't go, Mr. Connor. As a writer, this ought to be right up your street.
Don't miss a word.
I never saw you looking better, Red. You're getting that fine, tawny look.
Oh, we're going to talk about me, are we? Goody.
It's astonishing what money can do for people. Don't you agree, Mr. Connor? Not too much, you know, just more than enough. Now, take Tracy, for example. There's never a blow that hasn't been softened for her. Never a blow that won't be softened. As a matter of fact, it even changed her shape. She was a dumpy little thing at one time.
Only as it happens, I'm not interested in myself for the moment.
Not interested in yourself? You're fascinated, Red. You're far and away your favorite person in the world.
Dexter, in case you don't know...
Of course, Mr. Connor, she's a girl who's generous to a fault.
To a fault, Mr. Connor?
Except to other people's faults. For instance, she never had any understanding of my deep and gorgeous thirst.
That was your problem.
Granted. But you took on that problem with me when you took me, Red. You were no helpmate there. You were a scold.
It was disgusting. It made you so unattractive.
A weakness, sure. And strength is her religion, Mr. Connor. She finds human imperfection unforgivable. And when I gradually discovered that my relationship to her was supposed to be not that of a loving husband and a good companion, but... Oh, never mind.
Say it.
But that of a kind of high priest to a virgin goddess. Then my drinks grew deeper and more frequent, that's all.
I never considered you as that, nor myself.
You did without knowing it. Oh. And the night that you got drunk on champagne and climbed out on the roof and stood there, naked, with your arms out to the moon, wailing like a banshee.
I told you I'd never have the slightest recollection of doing any such thing.
I know, you drew a blank. You wanted to. Mr. Connor, what would you... Oh.
A nice story for Spy, incidentally.
Too bad we can't supply photographs of you on the roof.
Honestly, the fuss you made over that silly, childish...
It was enormously important and most revealing. The moon is also a goddess, chaste and virginal.
Stop using those foul words. Dexter, what are you trying to make me out as?
Tracy, what do you fancy yourself as?
I don't know that I fancy myself
as... When I read you were going to marry Kittredge, I couldn't believe it. That's why I'm here. How in the world could he even think of it?
Because he's everything you're not. Mm. He's been poor, he's had to work, and he's had to fight for everything. And I love him as I never even began to love you.
Maybe so, but I doubt it. I think it's just a swing for me. But it's too violent a swing. Kittredge is no great tower of strength, you know, Tracy. He's just a tower.
You hardly know him.
And I hardly know him as to know him well. And perhaps it offends my vanity to have anyone who was even remotely my wife remarry so obviously beneath her.
But how dare you, any of you in this day and age, use such an idiotic...
I'm talking about the difference in mind and spirit. You could marry Mac, the night watchman. I'd cheer for you. Kittredge is not for you.
You bet he's for me. He's a great man and a good man. Already he's of national importance.
Okay, I stop here, and we would need hours to comment on this conversation because it's so powerful and also quite violent, and also it's conveying so many values about democracy, like, you know, what is spiritual or social quality, but also, and this is what I wanted to show you in this small scene, it's also about, you know, what matters, what is important to people. And at some point, C.K., Dexter Haven tells his ex-wife, Tracy, that, you know, the event where when she got, you know, drunk and naked and on the roof, it's something that was immensely important, and she doesn't want to acknowledge this importance. And so the fight is about values, of course, and about what is important and what counts. And so this is also the philosophical and ethical importance of these movies, and you have this in quotation four and in the on the handout where Cavell says that importance is an important word for C.K. Dexter Haven. So this idea of importance is also something that you find in Wittgenstein. So this is very striking. For us, and I share this with Juliet. Maybe it's the greatest lesson of the investigation, the fact that you have to change your vision of importance. And really, what is shared, these values that are shared, in these films that were seen by, you know, millions of people, is really this location, this relocation of importance and interest and the focus of what really matters. And this is also something Cavell pursues when he talks about film and the ontology of film, because very often there are these big discussions in analytic philosophy about, you know, what kind of objects you have in fiction and on screen. And Cavell simply says that, you know, this idea, the question of what these objects are, has only one source of data for its answer, namely the appearance and significance of just these objects and people that are in fact to be found in the succession of films or passages of film that matter to us. So this idea that what is important is actually what matters to you, this is really at the core of the kind of moral education that you get from these films. These were very popular. And this is what is to be understood in this idea of popular culture. And in culture, you have this idea in the German, like in the German Bildung, like you constitute yourself. And here, popular culture, you see, it's really about philosophical, ethical education of a public and a shared education. So it's not, you know, the institution of a socially targeted corpus, but it is a way to claim the philosophical value of something that is sometimes neglected. And so this is what Cavell claimed. So it was in the 1970s, he claimed this, and 1980s. He was claiming this for mainstream Hollywood cinema. But now this idea, I think, is really true most about other practices and bodies of work, such as television series, because film has become, except for a few blockbusters that we can share and have a conversation about, but there are very few of them. So what is the object of moral conversations? It's really the TV shows. And so the kind of audience that they have is the only thing that is comparable to the audience of these films that were shaping the public ethics. And so it's very important also to understand that by popular culture, you don't mean popular like, you know, folklore or kind of, you know, early stage of culture. It's not that, because it's a kind of further elaborated stage of culture. And this is where also you have this form of education and cultivation of your self and subjective taste, and this subjectivation that takes place through sharing and commenting and conversations, this ordinary material that is integrated into ordinary life. So today, if you want to say we are all self-made men and women, it's also true. Popular culture, but maybe more with film. And so this is why it is very important to understand what Cavell meant by the philosophical relevance of a film, which is not only, you know, what the critics or intellectual class have to say about them, but the fact that this film has maintained a contact with the public and somehow empower the individual to have his own experience, his own vision. And so this is also why Cavell does not speak of seeing a film like an ecstatic experience, but he's interested in the practice of movie going. So it's very different. The experience of seeing a movie, a popular movie, if we keep with his example, is something that is completely different if you go, if you are with some people or others. So it's not the same. It's not the same thing. And so this is also this popular culture conception in Cavell that leads him to reject both the critics' contempt for very popular forms of film that are seen as degraded, because there is this kind of condescendence. Even today, you know, everybody likes TV shows and there are lots of conversation, but there is often a kind of condescendence about the material. Like, you know, it's not that smart, but you are very smart because you like them, you know, something like that. Well, you know, you see what I mean. But anyway, Cavert always bases his hermeneutic work on what he calls the intelligence that a film has already brought to bear in its making. So there is an intelligence, a kind of collective intelligence, not only the director or the writer, but this kind of whole community, like the actors, you know, other people who are doing the film and who are producing this work. So it's democratic in many ways. And so today, what this perspective Cavert introduced on popular film is even more valid for television series, but also everything that emerges out of this social media universe, because many series, we call them TV shows, but many are now produced by the internet, you know, giants, and it's also a very important evolution. But it's really something that, of course, provides a larger democratization of culture, and it's an element that is really, really important, even if the kind of education that was provided, that is provided by TV, is something that appeared probably more in the 1990s, when you have the first, you know, big shows like ER or The West Wing or Friends. I'm talking to the older generation. Maybe it doesn't mean anything for many of you, but for many of us, it was really meaningful to have these shows that were, you know, on prime time in the evening, not in during the day, and who showed very, interesting situation related to work and some kind of competence that you were gaining by watching, you know, even ER, you become very learned about, you know, some kind of medical vocabulary, or in The West Wing. So it's a way to initiate the viewer into new forms of life and vocabularies that are first kind of opaque, and then you gradually learn to master. And so it's really like in the beginning of the investigations, when you are in a world when you listen to words and you don't know what you know people are talking about, and then you end up being part of this form of life. And so also these TV shows, they call your attention to ordinary behavior, to everyday, you know, micro choices, and also to the characters and to the individuals' types of expressing themselves and making their claims and having, you know, this kind of polyphony that you have, you know, more and more in TV shows. You know, at the beginning, you had more, you know, like one hero, like, you know, Columbo, and a man, usually, Starsky and Hutch, and you have two, but now you have, in the popular TV shows, you have really some kind of big group of people, kind of collective hero. It began with Friends, actually, this kind of, you know, ensemble thing. And it's not only anecdotal, you know, it's really because you need to connect to as many people as possible in order to get your own moral education. And this is also something that is specific to these TV shows, even if now you see them more on the, you know, on the laptop or on the phone, maybe. I don't know how you can do it, but, you know, you can watch. I couldn't do it, but you can watch a TV show or film on a phone. But to watch it, you know, in the 90s or early 2000s, at home, on a TV or show, it's something that introduces these shows into the ordinary life. So, and it's something that connects it to home. And so it's something that really articulates the private and the public in a different way than, you know, going to a film, to a cinema theater. So there's a kind of slipping into private private life somehow, and also introducing themselves into the big temporality of your everyday life, like, you know, the seasons and the year and the week and the days. So it's if you are not binge watching, of course, but if you are, even if you are an adept of binge watching, you know, binge watching, you still have to wait for the next episode of Game of Thrones, you know, for the next week. So even if you are, so there is this whole introduction in the general form of life of, you know, the years, the seasons, and waiting, also waiting, expecting. And this is, of course, something that gives a very strong power of education to this specific medium, I think. And this is why it has inherited the power of film. And we were, for example, we were at a great conference on gender studies at Wellesley 2 days ago, and I had the opportunity to talk about a great show, even if it's maybe not as, you know, high level as The West Wing, but the Buffy the Vampire Slayer, you know, it's a show that was, we are celebrating the 20 years of the first episode of Buffy. Buffy was really a great show in many counts, and I could talk about Buffy for the rest of the talk, but I won't because Juliet doesn't want me to. And but Buffy was really meant to give an education to the audience. It was really meant, and this is something just a Whedon claimed at the beginning, that he wanted to show to the teenage audience to see a young woman that was really a completely ordinary, little blonde, cute woman. Okay, but who was really capable of, you know, kick ass, as she said, and to be a very, you know, strong and violent and kill vampires, because it was a kind of inversion of the stereotype of the nice blonde that gets, you know, that get killed at the beginning of the horror movie and so on. And so it was a way to morally transform the audience by showing just showing the image on the screen, the shock of her image on the screen, of having this strength and capacity. And so more recently you have this, for example, this kind of shock of the image itself. You have this with Wonder Woman, the movie, if some have seen it. It's the same kind of influence that is aimed at. So anyway, this is really this kind of educational ambition of the shows is something that is permanent in most of the interesting TV shows you can see. So of course, there are some very, you know, high-level, exigeant, demanding shows like, you know, The Wire or the West Wing, who ask a lot to the public. But it's something you can find in every show, this ambition to educate and transform the audience. Like, there is a show I really like, also I won't talk about it either, but it's The Walking Dead. And in The Walking Dead, you really have also this ambition to have this moral education about, you know, what values are left if you have completely given up on a form of life. And so, of course, there was this great show in the 2000s, The West Wing. I don't know if some of you remember seeing it, but there was also in the conversations, just like in the conversations you've got in the Philadelphia Story and in the comedies, or these dialogues by Aaron Sorkin, you had this conversational style that aimed at educating the audience about the meaning of democracy, about what intelligence and social concern is. And this is really interesting, because when you had this world of the West Wing in the 2000s, it was a kind of ideal, because the show was a kind of reverse representation of the American political reality of the time, because at that time it was a kind of, you know, reactionary, idiotic government. So of course, I'm glad this is over, yeah? But anyway, so it was the ambition of showing what was a better world than the world that was happening at that time. So it was always a world to come. And so there was this ambition of the TV shows to somehow, a perfectionist ambition, to represent democracy. And so if you compare, for example, with House of Cards that appeared after, much later, in 2013, then you have, of course, you have something that has happened in the TV shows since the 2000s, the fact that people like very mean characters. This is something new, actually, well, more recent, but that has, of course, its utility. But also, you had a kind of disappointment with democracy that was expressed in the irony of the democratic rhetoric of House of Cards. And so the comparison between House of Cards and the West Wing is really something that also can help you understand the role of utopia in these shows, the fact that for a moment the TV shows were creating an alternative reality in order to respond to desires or demands to improve the world. And now it is very difficult to have this kind of democratic ambition in these shows. You have it in a show called American Crime, for example. I don't know if some are watching it, but that there is something that has been lost in the democratic hope that was expressed in the remarriage comedy and was expressed in the West Wing. So maybe because, you know, reality is much worse than House of Cards, actually. So it's very hard to find, you know, something that would redeem that. But also now you have in the TV shows, you have not this realist utopian dimension, but more this whole style or genre of dystopia. So you have much, much more dystopia than utopia. And this is maybe means something about the kind of teaching that these TV shows aim at producing. So if you think about movies like The Hunger Games or Divergent, or, you know, the TV shows like The Walking Dead and or The Leftovers, there you have a presentation of a world in which, you know, freedom, respect, and just the ordinary human form of life has disappeared. So it's a way to show us what our form of life is, because you see what is missing in these shows, but you also see the threat in our present world that could lead to these situations, like also in The Handmaid's Tale, which is also very pedagogical, exactly in the same way as Cavell says that these movies are. And so you see very well, so I just show, but it's going to be shorter, hopefully. I show you the beginning of The Leftovers. You.
You people called me. I'm returning your.
Sorry, I don't.
Yes, I am. I do. That's me. Sorry. Are you the same person I was just talking to? Seriously, I don't have the reference. When mommy was single in 20, she used to use quarters for this, but now she has to put money into a machine to get a card to put into another machine. Oh, God damn it! Come on! Broke, and the entire basement was flooded. I know, the water was totally up to the knees.
Okay, I did.
Exercise shit that he never uses, the washer dryer. I'm actually at the laundromat right now. Can you squeeze me in at 5 or something? Hold on. What do you think? There's a button, a red button. Yeah. Honey. Shh. It's okay, baby. Shh. Yeah. It's a red button. Oh my God. Just press it in with a pen or something. Oh. It's perfect. It'll start back up. Okay. I'm in the car right now. Can you make the formula? I'm going to be home and. Sam? Sam? Sam?
to that car seat. He was right here. He was right in that car seat. Sam, where are you, Sam? Sam, where are you?
I stop here because it could be longer, and I guess maybe some of you have seen this show. It has been 3 seasons. It's very impressive, and it's really the first scene where you have 2% of the population disappearing. And it's not much, not many people are disappearing, as you say, but it's really as if the leftovers, the leftover inhabitants of Earth cannot really live without these 2%. And so it's a kind of, so it's not exactly post-apocalyptic like The Walking Dead, but it shows you also the fragility of the human form of life, the fact that if you, you know, take away these people, there is something that is completely destroyed, and so this is something that is very, very powerful in this show. And I think this is also what is at stake in many TV shows now. It's really this kind of description, so of what is basic, what is essential to our form of life, and also it's again a kind of shift in ethics comparable to the shift you've got in pursuits of happiness, because you don't have, you know, this kind of normative, imperative forms of morality, but it's much more about the kind of attention or attachment you have to the characters. And so it's also about what I call the ethics of care. So I don't want to talk too much about this aspect, but it's really very strongly connected to the kind of relation we've got to this material. And this is what makes also these TVs part of this new scheme, this new form of life we have with this popular culture, because this is really a kind of very intimate relationship we've got with these television shows, because they are part of our ordinary lives, but also because they empower us in our perception of situations and moments and value, and also because the kind of care you have for these stories and for the characters is something that is not a very, you know, abstract moral value or general principle, but is something that is really connected to every different situation. So it's really a kind of ethics that is particularist. And you have this, for example, even if it's an old show, I don't know if some of you had used to watch ER, for example. It was very interesting because it was about particular cases, and it was about what it is to care about, but it was both describing care and eliciting care from the audience. And this is something you have also in all kinds of shows now, even, you know, the security defense shows like, you know, Homeland. It's a way to have you care about security or political situations. And when you remember a show like ER or The West Wing, it's this initiation into a form of life that somehow empowers you to care for the particular situations and choices. And so this is also why what is usually seen as a constraint, you know, when people call this the small screen, like, you know, small screen is not something less. Actually, the small screen is something more, because you have can have, you know, faces, expressions for a long time on the small screen. That it's more difficult on the big screen. And so you really have a better connection and influence. And so this is why, again, you can also have an access to all the actors' modes of expression and moral texture, style of speaking, and behaving. So everything that is actually part of the definition of ethics, you would prefer to general, you know, law and principles, just the way people are and their personal quality. And this is also the way these people care for others and the way you are going to care and focus your attention to a character, on a character, sorry, even if it's, of course, a very unpleasant or, you know, weird character. You actually care. And this is something that really takes the viewer's moral capacities seriously. And so this is why you have a representation of care, but you have also a care that is produced by this show that aim at attaching you to the characters or the situations and also transforming you. So there is still this idea of a moral transformation, but also a moral transformation that is both perfectionist but also democratic. And if you remember, then in Dewey's book, The Public and Its Problems, he defines the public on the basis of confrontation with a problematic situation in which individuals experience a difficulty that they initially perceive as coming from their private life and for which they must find public expression and legitimacy. This is exactly what these shows are doing. It's really going public. And so the characters in this fiction and TV are so well anchored and morally guided, and they are often clear in their moral expressions, but they are not archetypes. So somehow they can be entrusted to you and made available to the imagination of each. And so as if we are to take care of them ourselves. And I think it's very important, and if the closing of a series after, you know, 7 years or 15 years like ER, it's something that is very crucial, because you can understand that the showrunners and writers are really helping you, you know, getting prepared to be separated from these characters and somehow, you know, learn to live without them, but also with them, because, like, it's very interesting, for example, the end of the series, Lost. I don't know if some of you have seen Lost. Okay, so I don't want to talk about that. But this is it's a show where you really have a kind of enactment of the separation and, you know, getting used to live without them. Some maybe have seen the last season of Mad Men. Maybe you can understand this, because it's really a way to, you know, teach you how to progressively give up on the characters. And I think it's something that is also part of this educational and utopian character of these shows. And this is also the kind of care they produce. So I just want to finish. Yes, I'm almost done. And because I have invoked Cavell's claim regarding the philosophical value of Hollywood movies. And you remember, you may know that he really placed them at the same level of the greatest works of philosophy. In chapter 2 of Pursuits of Happiness, he makes this big comparison between Kant, and Critique of Pure Reason, and It Happened One Night as definition of our access to the world. And it's just so completely convincing. So it's not a joke. It's really a kind of rivality between film and philosophy. And so what Cavell claimed in the 70s and 80s about mainstream Hollywood movies that were, you know, the common treasure, they were at that time underestimated both as works of culture and works of thought. But for me, what he was doing then applies now to these other bodies of work, other intellectually underestimated practices such as television series or the series on the internet, or also some kind of participative creation of shows on the internet, collective intelligence. And for me, these series have succeeded somehow, maybe not replaced, but succeeded film in the task of providing moral education to adolescents and adults. And maybe because it's the way we choose what we like in this culture, as Robert Warshaw said in quotation one, is something that gives you the kind of power that helps you perfect yourself and progress. So maybe this sounds very, you know, a little too optimistic, but this idea of popular culture as a place for education, the education of grown-ups, is a way also to look for a new kind of perfecting of the self, but by becoming part of, or discussing, or sharing a material that is both public and ordinary and woven into everyday life. And this is, in this sense, that, as Warshaw said, we are all self-made men and women, and that TV shows are maybe a new place for public education through our private tastes and choices. Thank you.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by Sandra Laugier, professor of philosophy at Université de Paris and Panthéon Sorbonne. Professor Laugier's lecture was titled Philosophy of Popular Culture, Skepticism, Care, and Ordinary Life. It was presented by the Boston University Department of Philosophy, co-sponsored by the BU Center for the Study of Europe and the French Consulate of Boston. Tonight's moderator was Boston University Professor of Philosophy, Juliet Floyd. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You can also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth, with help from Ian McCarn. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Thanks for joining us.